Hi, I'm Sam Broadfoot QC.
And I'm David Locke QC.
And welcome to the sixth podcast in this series, which looks at the law relating to police pensions. And I think this is part three on the series on injuries. We are going to cover three main areas in this podcast. Firstly, a detailed look at the amounts that injury pensioners are entitled to be paid. Second, Regulation 12 awards for those who are totally and permanently disabled as a result of police service. And third, the structure for reviewing ill health and injury pensions. The full detail relating to these topics is set out in the chapter that David has written and which is being published at the same time as this podcast. I also need to repeat, of course, the warning that we are providing general observation without any acceptance of liability, and nothing in this podcast series should be taken as legal advice in an individual case. In the last podcast, we explained that the Police Injury Benefit Regulations 2006 provided that police officers who became permanently disabled as a result of a duty injury were entitled to an award, and this is defined in the regulations. So, David, can you set out what exactly is meant by an award?
Well, Sam, the award for an injury pensioner is the amount they're entitled to receive as defined by Regulation 11, and a table in Schedule 3 of the IB regulations. Awards of injury pensions are paid free of income tax, and they form two parts. Firstly, a gratuity, and secondly, a pension. Let's deal with the gratuity first. The gratuity is a one-off lump sum payment. Now, that lump sum depends on the degree of disablement of the former officer, and we talked in previous podcasts on what was meant by degree of disablement. And there are four bands for degree of disablement: 0 to 25, 25 to 50, 50 to 75, and 75 to 100. And the amount of the gratuity depends on the band and is a percentage of the former officer's average pensionable pay, which is a term known as APP, and the precise way you calculate that is defined in the regulations. And that depends on the band. So a band 3 pensioner is entitled to a gratuity of 35% of their APP. So if the officer had a pensionable income of, say, £40,000 a year, the gratuity is £15,000.
Yes, and this is set out in the table in Schedule 3 of the regulations. That table also fixes the second element, the pension, described as a minimum income guarantee. But the rate of pension depends on the number of years' service the officer has delivered prior to retirement, again in four bands. So, for example, a band 3 officer who had between 15 and 25 years' service is entitled to a pension of 75% of his average pensionable pay. So that's the headline starting point. But even that is not a fixed sum, is it? Because 75% of any other pension is deducted, typically an ill health pension, and 100% of some welfare benefits, such as industrial injuries benefit and employment support allowance. These are deducted as well. So the final calculation is a bit more complicated. Let's turn then to look at indexation. How does that work?
Well, official pensions, that is pensions payable by the government under a whole variety of statutory schemes, have to take account of inflation. And the way that it works is that the same rate of increase for pensions is applied as is applied for statutory welfare benefits like employment support allowance. Now, the legal route by which this is undertaken is a bit complicated, but it starts at Regulation 29 of the IB regulations. But even that's slightly complex because the level of the pension is generally fixed in the final year of service, and the pension should be start to be paid from retirement. Hence, the pension is the sum that's paid in the first year after retirement, and then the indexation provisions increase that sum year by year for each year after retirement.
Given that the concept of degree of disablement is a mixed medical and economic concept, as we discussed in earlier podcasts, I think it would be useful to turn to what happens to the loss of earning capacity of a former police officer at the point that he would have reached his compulsory retirement age, even if he had continued to serve as a police officer. The Home Office position used to be that the pension should simply be reduced to band one, didn't it? I.e. the argument was that once you reached compulsory retirement age, your loss of earning capacity as a result of the injury is significantly reduced because most people don't work beyond that point anyway.
Yes, that's right. The Home Office Circular 46/2004 originally suggested that a compulsory retirement age, which is known as CRA, or state retirement age, which is SRA, the pension should be reduced to band one, that is the lowest band, in the absence of a, quote, cogent reason, unquote, to the contrary. I was involved in a case called Simpson in the High Court because the officers challenged that decision, or that guidance, and the High Court ruled that that cogent reason test was unlawful because it was not part of the regulations. It was also wrong to suggest that individuals over the age of 65 had no earning capacity. Many pensioners choose to work in one form of employment or another, and those that do not do so make the choice not to exercise their earning capacity, but they still have it. They still have the ability to work, but they just chose not to do so because they're able to live on a pension income. And I've mentioned in passing that that decision was decided in the Court of Appeal by three judges who were all aged between 65 and 70, all of whom were exercising their earning capacity by judging at the time. They decided that police officers had the same level of earning capacity. A second challenge was then brought in respect to the guidance about compulsory retirement age, and that led to the circular being withdrawn entirely by the government. However, the CRA date may well lead to an alteration in the degree of disablement for the purpose of Regulation 37, because when doing the calculations, the uninjured earning capacity of the police officer cannot continue to be assumed to be a police salary. After all, if the officer hadn't been injured and then required to retire at an earlier stage, they would in any event, have to leave the police service at CRA, at their compulsory retirement age. Therefore, even if everything in their medical position stays the same, there's a new question, which is what salary that person would have been entitled to earn outside the police after CRA. And that may be different to a police salary, and so, in principle, it could lead to a change in the degree of disablement.
Yes, and in Simpson, the court made it absolutely clear, as we discussed in earlier podcasts, that where one is considering whether the quantum decision on the present degree of disablement should be reviewed, the statutory scheme requires an assessment as to whether there has been a substantial alteration in the degree of disablement first. So that looks at the end of the process. Let's go back to the beginning, because one of the difficulties in this area is that injury pensions are only ever considered and then awarded after retirement. That process can take place in the first year after retirement, but often does not take place until later years. There has been some litigation about the extent to which an injury pension should be backdated to the date of retirement when it is awarded at a later date. I know that you have been acting for the police officer in that litigation, so perhaps you should explain where we are at the moment.
Well, this is a particularly difficult area. The case in question concerns Sergeant Lloyd Kelly, who was a South Yorkshire police officer, who developed post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of a series of really quite horrific experiences that he encountered during his service as a police officer. And he was compulsory retired in 2005. Now, the force were on notice that his disablement was likely to have been caused by his police service, but he was far too mentally ill to take any notice of his pension rights at the time, and no one from the force appears to have focused on his entitlement to an injury pension as opposed to his entitlement to an ill health pension. So he was paid his ill health pension for the next 11 years, but then in 2016 he stumbled across a website which led him to believe that he might be entitled to an injury pension as well. So he approached the force and asked for an assessment. And to be fair to the force, they didn't say it was too late, but rightly they arranged for an assessment. And this decided that Sergeant Kelly was eligible for a Band 3 injury pension, and this was awarded to him 12 years after he retired. Now, there's a really good case that the force acted wrongly in failing to have him assessed for his injury pension back in 2005. But it may be too late to bring that an action about that. But in any event, that breach wouldn't matter if he remained entitled to pension payments referable back to 2005. Mr. Kelly's case was he was entitled to that pension, but the force disagreed and they only backdated his pension payments to May 2016 when he first applied to them for the injury pension. Mr. Kelly exercised his right to appeal to the Crown Court and he won. We're talking about appeal rights and the complicated process of appeal rights in the next podcast. However, the Chief Constable then challenged the decision of the Crown Court in the High Court, and in substance, the Chief Constable lost. Thus, the present state of the law is that injury pensioners are entitled to their award from the date of retirement, even if they're awarded the pension in later years, and therefore they, in effect, get a back payment, a single back payment, backdated to the date of retirement, and then the new pension paid monthly from then on. But there's a caveat. The Chief Constable has obtained permission to appeal the High Court's decision to the Court of Appeal, and therefore they will be hearing later this year or early next year to see whether the High Court was right to say that pensions are backdated to the date of retirement.
That sounds like another area where the legitimate interests of the police officer are clashing with the need of the force to manage their budget as much as possible. And some listeners may remember our discussion about Andrew McLaughlin, which demonstrates how unsatisfactory, from budgetary perspectives, a long backdate can be, although it was paid in that case. In the war pensions context, it used to be the case that you would normally only be paid a war pension from the date that you claimed it, assuming it was successful, of course. There were some narrow exceptions for backdating, for example, if medical opinion had changed, but this was not normally the case. I suspect the difference relates to historic differences in the schemes, but it is interesting from a comparative perspective. It will be interesting to see what decision the Court of Appeal reaches. Let's now turn to a different subject, namely Regulation 12 awards. These are awards for officers who become totally and permanently disabled as a result of duty injury. This is a generous provision, but applies in relatively few cases because totally and permanently disabled means that the duty injury has led to the officer being totally and permanently unable to undertake any form of employment. It therefore only applies to officers who have the most severe injuries. But it is a valuable benefit because the lump sum is either 5 years average pensionable pay, APP, or 4 years total remuneration, whichever is the lower. So an officer with an APP of £40,000 can claim a gratuity of up to £200,000. However, Regulation 12 only applies where the person becomes or became totally and permanently disabled as a result of the injury within 12 months of receiving that injury. And there is a particular problem over the so-called 12-month rule in this regulation. So, David, can you explain what that is?
Certainly. As you say, the regulation provides that the former officer's total and permanent disablement must have arisen within 12 months of receiving the relevant injury. Now, there's no real logic to support the 12-month rule, and it prejudices police officers who develop psychological injuries, where there may well be a significant delay between the onset of symptoms, and officers who have physical injuries, where you'd expect the symptoms to be triggered straight away, but not always. So the officer who suffers PTSD as a result of work-related events, but who struggles on for a further 12 months earning a police salary, but then develops serious symptoms, which means he never works again, may well be refused a Regulation 12 award because he fails the 12-month rule. Now, that was the situation in a case called Colin Broughton. And the officer challenged the lawfulness of the 12-month rule, arguing it was unlawful because it amounted to disability discrimination. Now, I acted for the officer in that case, and permission for judicial review to challenge the regulations was refused both on paper by the High Court and then in renewal by the High Court. But permission was given by the Court of Appeal because they thought the case raised serious issues. And then the case was compromised when the Secretary of State agreed to make a Regulation 12 award to Mr. Broughton, albeit on an ex gratia basis. And then the Secretary of State has said that he will do a further review to see whether the 12-month rule is justified. Now, that review has to report back by February 2021. At this point, there's no indication, though, that the review has ever commenced, and that's probably something to do with the coronavirus issues. But any officer who's affected by the 12-month rule should seek specialist legal advice because the position is complex and far from clear.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. That's really interesting regarding the review, though. Perhaps we will have news about this when we record our next podcast. Just like in one of our last ones, we discussed the unlawful pension transfer provisions, and a few days ago, the government published its consultation document. Maybe someone very important is listening to us.
Yes, I hope so. But maybe we overestimate the strength of our influence.
Well, there we go. Right, so next we are coming on to the subject of reviews of ill health and injury pensions. It seems to me that there are three areas in the regulations which can result in a review of a pension after it has been awarded. First, all three pension schemes include provisions allowing the force to review the case of a person receiving an ill health pension in order to determine if his disablement has ceased. Clearly, if unexpectedly the pensioner has recovered from the illness or injury and he or she could now return to work as a police officer, there is no justification for continuing to pay an ill health pension.
Yes, that's right. Ill health pensions to be paid to people who are disabled from being able to perform their police duties. If an officer can return to police duties, there's no justification for paying a pension. But there are a number of points to bear in mind. First, the test is whether the officer could do all the duties of a police officer, not just work in some areas of policing. Secondly, the ill health pension is only removed if the officer's offered the opportunity to return to the force at the same rank as he had before he was required to retire. And thirdly, if the SNP does reach the view that an officer's disablement has ceased, the officer can appeal to the Police Medical Appeal Board against that finding, and they'll go through the exercise again.
So in relation to your first two points, David, what you're really saying is it is a fairly demanding test, and in practice, this does not occur very often.
I think that's right, yes.
The second area of reviews concerns the different tiers of ill health pension under the 2006 and 2015 regulations. As we explained in earlier podcasts, an upper tier pension is payable to someone who is incapable of working 30 hours per week in any form of regular employment. Each of these pension schemes has a provision to allow the SNP to review the former officer in order to determine whether that condition is still met. If the SNP considers that the former officer could now work 30 or more hours per week, the former officer will drop to a lower tier ill health pension. Once again, the decision can be challenged to the Police Medical Appeal Board.
Yes, and the third area of reviews concerns reviews of the degree of disablement of a pensioner who is in receipt of an injury pension. And these reviews are under Regulation 37 of the IB regulations, and they have generated a huge amount of controversy.
Yes, the guide that we are publishing with this podcast explains the details of this. But in summary, the first question for the PPA is whether a suitable interval has taken place since the award of the pension or the last review. If the PPA decides that a suitable interval has taken place, the PPA is required to appoint the SNP to carry out a review. I understand, though, that there is an open question as to whether the PPA is entitled to decide that a pensioner should not be reviewed again for the rest of his life. The question as to whether a whole life interval is possible is one of the issues in the case where you appeared for the officers, and we are presently awaiting judgment from the High Court, so perhaps the less said about this at this point, the better.
That's right. If the SNP is appointed to do the review, the case of Belinda Laws, which we spoke about in a previous podcast, explains that the first question for the SNP is whether there's been an alteration in the degree of disablement of the officer since the last review, or if this is the first review since the date of the award. If there has been an alteration, the next question is whether the alteration degree of disablement has been substantial, and the SNP only gets the right to perform the degree of disablement exercise afresh if she decides there has been a substantial alteration. And even then, the SNP is bound by the clinical findings made by a previous SNP concerning the causes of the duty injury.
There is some controversy over precisely what happens if the pensioner refuses to take part in the review process and thereby seeks to prevent the SNP making an adverse decision.
Again, that's right. The Chief Constable has powers under Regulation 33 to take back decision-making if the pensioner either fails to attend an appointment with the SNP or fails to submit to a medical examination at that appointment. Now, the precise meaning of this regulation has never been discussed in the High Court, and we're awaiting guidance from the judgment in the case of Wright and others versus the Chief Constable of Staffordshire, which was heard in the High Court last week. And once again, it's probably not sensible to say anything further at this point. We'll publish some guidance once the judgment has been received.
This case also raises the difficult question as to whether injury pensioners have a duty to provide access to relevant medical records in advance of an SNP review appointment. But given that that again is something we're waiting for judgment on in the Wright case, we can't say much more about that at present.
I think that's right.
No doubt we will be doing a separate article or podcast on that when the judgment emerges. In any event, what is slightly clearer is that the Chief Constable and the pensioner can both agree that any medical decision should be subject to a reconsideration by either the same medical authority or a substitute medical authority if the original medical authority is not available. And the recent case of Boscovich limits the circumstances in which the Chief Constable has a positive duty to refer a case for reconsideration, but this power can be used by both sides to avoid a judicial review case if there is an obvious problem with the decision of an SNP or the PMAB.
That's right. The next question to consider is how the review decision takes effect. Now, that issue arose in a case called Fisher, and it involves a cautionary tale for pensioners. The facts of Mr. Fisher's case were as follows. Mr. Fisher was on a Band 4 pension and was subject perfectly properly to an SNP review. And the SNP decided to drop his award down to Band 3. And that obviously produced a reduction in his level of pension, and he wasn't very happy about it, and so he lodged an appeal to the PMAB. The PMAB looked at the matter again and decided the SNP was right to say there had been a substantial alteration in his degree of disablement. So yes, in principle, the pension should be reviewed. But it said that the SNP had made the wrong calculation about the new degree of disablement, and the PMAB felt that Mr. Fisher should drop all the way down to a Band 1 ward, thus very substantially reducing his pension. At that point, the PPA, the Chief Constable, tried to backdate the effects of the Police Medical Appeal decision to the date of the SNP award. Now, for complex reasons in that case, there was a long delay between the SNP decision and the PMAB hearing. And the consequence was the force argued that Mr. Fisher ought to have been paid a Band 1 pension from the date of the SNP review, and therefore he'd been overpaid by about £20,000. Now, the facts of this case show a pensioner needs to think very carefully before appealing to the PMAB, because there can be cases where a pensioner loses even more as a result of appealing. And the outcome of the Fisher case was the judge decided, in fact, there was no overpayment. He decided between the date of the SNP decision and the date of the PMAB decision, Mr. Fisher was entitled to a Band 3 pension. And therefore, he was paid the right amount, and there was no overpayment. He didn't have to pay anything back. And in the end, it didn't matter, because Mr. Fisher succeeded in having the decision quashed on other grounds. But that leaves a potential unfairness for pensioners, because a pensioner can have a Band 3 award, which, say, is dropped to a Band 1 reward on a review, if he appeals and is successful in showing there never was a substantial alteration in his degree of disablement and the pension is restored back to a Band 3, then that takes effect from the date of the appeal hearing. But the logic of Mr. Fisher's case is that it's quite difficult for the officer to claim that he was entitled to a Band 3 pension all the time, because he would have been awarded the Band 1 pension between the SNP decision and the appeal decision. And that of itself raises the question as to whether the appeal is an adequate alternative remedy, or whether, if there was a gross error by an SNP, a decision could be quashed by way of judicial review without waiting to go to the Police Medical Appeal Board to correct or partially correct the error. Again, this was an obiter decision. It's possible the judge faced with the same question in a new case will come to a different decision. But at the moment, Fisher raises the law, and therefore pensions go up and down depending on each decision by a medical authority.
Once again, I would remind people that there is much more detailed consideration of the issues we've covered in this podcast in David's chapter, which is chapter 6 of the guide and is being released at the same time as this podcast. So many thanks for listening, and particular thanks go to our super producer, Amy Jansen, for all her help. We are coming towards the end of the podcast series on police pensions. The next podcast will involve a look at the legal options for both pensioners and forces who want to challenge decisions made within the police pension system. And the final podcast will be a wider discussion between us about the complexities of police pensions, how decision making could be improved, and what is likely to be coming for both police pensioners and for the forces. Many thanks for listening, and goodbye for now.